Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
This shouldn't be a newsflash to anybody, except to some of the anonymous cockroaches on social media, tribalists who keep saying Cass is a Republican. I'm not a Republican. The wars pushed by Bush that I once supported and later came to regret, and the Illinois Combine Boys, from Big Bill Cellini to Governors Thompson, Edgar, George Ryan, prisoner George Ryan, they took care of that. And I'm not a Democrat either. Democratic thievery in Chicago and Illinois over the last 100 years, from the time those inspectors came and took the steaks from my father's store, and later when I saw how they put poor people on government support like junkies on heroin, all that cured me of either being a Republican or a Democrat. I'm of no party. But if anything, you could say I'm a seriously conservative iconoclast. Which brings me to this story of the Nazi running for Congress as a Republican in the 3rd District, the one out in the southwestern suburbs from Burbank to Lockport. That's the district I live in. And this Nazi's name is Arthur Jones. I don't want to give his repugnant, anti-Semitic, racist views any publicity. But I do want to talk about his... how'd he get on the ballot? Holocaust denier running in Congress has no opponents in Republican primary, said the Washington Post. And the Huffington Post, the one that's even farther to the left, says, an actual Nazi is about to be the only GOP candidate in congressional race in Illinois. This is really easy pickings for the hard left. And liberals like those peasants who pick up coffee beans in the turds of the Civic Cats in Sumatra or wherever they are. Cat poop coffee is expensive and it pays, and so picking up those turd, pre-digested coffee beans in them can make people money. And so liberals are picking up this turd. And I understand the politics of it. But here's the thing. Jones shouldn't have been anywhere near the ballot if there had been a functioning Republican Party in Illinois. Democratic boss Mike Madigan must have known. But it wasn't his job to say anything. This Nazi thing is a shiny object now. You hold it and you shake it and you twinkle it. And you tell people, look here, look at this Nazi thing. And it distracts from other issues. What really bothered me were the responses from the Republicans. The Illinois Republican Party in our country have no place for Nazis like Arthur Jones, said Illinois Republican Party Chairman Tim Schneider. We strongly oppose his racist views, blah, 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 blah. And Governor Browner condemned him this way. There is no room for neo-Nazis in American politics. I condemn this man in the strongest terms, blah, 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 blah. Arthur Jones is a perennial candidate who does not in any way represent or espouse the values and principles of the Republican Party. Sean Morrison, he's the Cook County Republican chairman, and State Central Committeeman Republican for that district. That's what he told Ted Slowick of the Tribune newspapers. I unequivocally do not support his candidacy, blah, 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 blah. An individual like Mr. Jones, who denies the mass murder of more than 6 million Jewish people and the murder of 17 million men, women, and children at the hands of the Nazis, merits no further response. Oh, really, Sean Morrison? Well, I'm not defending this psycho Nazi and his drooling, hateful talk. But Sean, that's your district. And Bruce Rauner, that's the Republican Party you control. You're responsible. You didn't find a candidate. You let this guy get on the ballot. You've made this Republican Party a Bruce Rauner party. I get it. But that's why this happened, because you didn't do your job. You're the reason this creep is out there representing Republicans in the fall. You weren't watching. You know who watches? Boss Madigan. He watches everything. He pays attention to detail. He pays attention to his work. And you wonder why the Boss Madigan runs things? Now, Boss Madigan pays attention to something else, too, besides Palermo's Pizza on 95th Street. You know what he pays attention to? This podcast. And you know who else is going to be listening? Rahm Emanuel. And others. And we have a guest, Paul Vallis, who might be the one to take Rahm out at City Hall. This is the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
I'm John Cass, mild-mannered columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and with me, as always, is Jeff Carlin, producer of WGN's Radio's The Rokon Show with Anna DeVellantis. And before, Jeff, we get to Paul Vallis.
Yeah.
How you doing, man?
I am good. Snowy. I know it's been quite a weekend, and as people may or may not know, as we tape this, it was the city essentially shut down for some snow.
Listen,
but I was amazed.
You're amazed that there wasn't as much snow early on as they said?
I'm amazed that Lakeshore Drive was wide open this morning. I didn't have any issue. My side streets were tough, except for the one side street in front of the alderman's house. You know, that was thoroughly plowed. But our street was not, which it's the same street. It's just it's ironic that there's, you know, some magic line that makes that happen. But I'm not bitter.
It's a coincidence.
Yeah, it's a coincidence.
Yeah.
Very snowy, yeah.
It's snowy, but you know what? What I really can't stand are those weathercasters who scream, "It's snowing!" And our friend, we have a good friend, John Dempsey on 89 WLS, where we used to work. And by the way, I talked to Lauren Cohn.
Uh-huh.
Maybe she might come on.
I ran into her too. I'm looking forward to that.
So anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah,
Dempsey, these
weathercasters, Dempsey and all these guys, but not just Dempsey, because he's good at, he uses his voice as an instrument.
Right.
A fine instrument. I use mine as, like, the broken knuckles on my two hands. But he's always going, "The weather, it's going to snow." The way he says it, it gets right into your belly. Like, it makes you, and these weathercasters, even worse, they're screaming, saying, "Snow, we're going to die." What is with these people? Why do they hype it up so much?
Well, it's better yes than no. I mean, remember the old days where the only way you knew if it was going to snow is if you were reading a newspaper, staring at a TV, or listening to a radio.
Right.
So people had to shout. You know, you had a radio. You had to make sure people caught it. You had to make sure they knew.
It's all about getting them freaked out so they show up. There were like almost 10 car accidents at the gas station where people were all trying to get gas. Like, I got to get gas. And
someone messaged me saying that the Costco, one of the Costcos in the suburbs, it was like a 40-minute line because people were worried about snow and not getting
get your
gas
bread.
And getting food. And
you know? And then what happened?
People stayed home. I mean, it's good to know. And I know a lot of businesses are closed or running on like a snow schedule. Not media, we're here.
I'll tell you one thing that really bothers me about media, and I have to say this is petty, this is selfish of me, this is the evil little John, like the bad angel in the cartoon, you know what I mean, the one on my left shoulder, the kind of little fat guy in the a black, I would say like a black onesie, you know, with a little tail. You know, black tail and black horns. Kind of like a cat suit, but mannish.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Right.
And he's out there and he's saying, "John, everyone's ripping you off on dibs. Everyone's ripping you off on dibs, John." And I realized it's true, Jeff. Judge Dibs started this talking about it in terms of dibs. I had all these commies of the left, all these, you know, let's get together and shovel snow for everyone. All these people in the media, and now everyone has given up that crap. Everyone's on the dibs train. WGN, Tomasello did one.
Yeah.
Dibs. They have the Dibs.
There's an art show, right, with chairs.
Ben Bradley, even Will Lee started writing Dibs stories. My old guy.
I know.
What is with this?
It's great. You know, you had a couple questions. We just someone that sent you, right?
Oh, do you have any?
I put them in front of you.
Oh, yes, I do. Okay. I'm going to have, let me see.
There were two
that I thought were...
And we have an official announcement for Dibs Court.
What's the announcement?
We have a new judge.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That's what I wanted to make clear. We have a High Chamberlain, Lord High Chamberlain of Dibs. That's Peter Bella, who was in the paper in my column on Dibs, talking about these Mama Lukes who are parking in this spot. And then another one came in. Here's Andrea Darless, WGN, on my Facebook when she went on the Judge Dibs posting.
Weighed in, yeah.
And she weighed in supporting Judge Dibs and Dibs and the Dibs Institution. She says, Dibs is very real and very necessary. Long live Dibs, said WGN's Andrea Darless. Isn't it lovely?
It is.
She's not only a good person, she's smart because she understands... If we don't have Dibs, what do we have?
All right, nothing.
Chaos.
Nothing.
So I've appointed her, Andrea Darless, as Associate Appellate Court Justice of Dibs, and I just ask her publicly, so it's no secret, that all she's got to do is pay my bag ban $50,000 in 20s, and it's all done.
Sounds good. You did have a question from a Robert Kania, I believe. I'm pronouncing it, Robert Kania.
Mm-hmm.
He says he's 15 and wants to learn about Dibs. And has his specific question is he allowed to claim Dibs if he clears out it with a snowblower? I'm assuming a spot.
Yeah.
He's not old enough to drive yet, so I'm assuming he's doing this for someone else, which raises an interesting question. Can you Dibs for somebody else?
If you're 15 years old and you have the initiative to get the snowblower and get out there and clean out a parking space, you can Dib Robert Kania. And I give you, as Judge Dibs, I give you the Dibstitution, Article 2, Section 5 of the Dibstitution deals with teenage snowblowers and says yes. And they can also put Dibs on it. And if they're really smart, they'll do it for money.
Yes. Oh, well, yeah, as a good capitalist.
In other words, I will plow your streets.
Mm-hmm.
This is libertarian. I am a libertarian. I told at the outset, right at the monologue, I said,
yeah.
I'm a libertarian iconoclast, conservative,
yeah.
Right? Okay, this is it. Kids, do the streets, do the Dibs.
There you go.
Charge the money, but you can't charge like by the hour.
Right, fair market.
You know what my kids did?
Hmm.
They just took in Betty and the. And one of my sons just took in the snowblower right before it snowed. Now, I've been asking
them.
I've been asking. I said, guys, can you please take the snowblower, take it in? You know, this is like months ago, weeks ago, before like Thanksgiving.
When it was still green.
Oh, man. And now I see it. Well, I'm not shoveling because I'm going to die of a heart attack. Easy. I don't need help.
Don't need to help that out, yeah. Interesting. In my neighborhood, I have to say, I have... Or my immediate neighbors. So we live on the alley,
mm-hmm.
and then we have row houses.
Mm-hmm.
You
live in the city.
In the city, and
I noticed that. You're very proud of that.
I am, and we do. It's fun because I'll get home and I'll see that the sidewalk hasn't been shoveled or it had snowed. So I'll shovel the sidewalk from my house to our neighbor's house and then the house on the other side. And we're all friends, and we have parties and stuff and hang out. And then I will not be home for 12, 15 hours, which is common. And I'll come home, and then my sidewalk will be shoveled, and the sidewalks will be shoveled. And I'll find out it was the person, four houses down who decided to jump in on this. And it's a very good communal feeling. And I think every neighbor should be like that. So I'm a hat tip to my neighbors.
Yeah, I like that. And especially,
just the sidewalks.
No, I think it's good that people help each other out. I think it's bad when... You're going to make it an enforcement, like some lefty commie
right.
socialist thing. Like the next thing you know, like I said, you run out of toilet paper, then you start eating tapirs at the zoo, like they're doing in Venezuela. You know what I mean? They're barbecuing
right.
them. Because that's what happens. You can't force people to do stuff. But out of the goodness of their heart, right?
Exactly.
And That's why Dibs is so perfect, because it helps you. It helps you get your snow out. It helps your neighbor. It helps everyone. It keeps order. Now, the question is, when will I release Dibs? Because right now I'm enforcing Dibs is okay. But I would say in a couple days from Friday, you know, that snow starts going down.
Maybe, yeah, I mean, you know. I think that what's the ruling? Is it 12 hours or 24 hours after the last snowfall you're set, or is it based on the amount of snow?
It's based on the amount of snow. It's based on whether I like you or not. Based on
the Chicago way.
It's right. It's based on whether, like, you like, say, your mom knows my uncle George. You know what I mean? Like, you know, kids together in the fields or like something like that, right?
Sure.
Because this is about Chicago, and this is the Chicago way.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by.
Well, like I said in the opening, Boss Madigan, Rahm Emanuel, everybody in politics, they're not going to tell their friends, hey, you've got to listen to the Chicago way. But they're listening now because of our next guest, Paul Vallis, former CEO of the Chicago Public Schools, crisis manager throughout the country, went to Haiti, New Orleans, elsewhere, is thinking about, actually, I think he's more than thinking about, he's planning a run for mayor of Chicago. Good morning, and welcome to the Chicago Way, Paul.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
So why do you want to run for mayor?
Well, I love the city. As you know, my parents were the children of Greek immigrants, grew up in the Roseland community. On my dad's side and my mother's side, Wood Street. You know,
Westsiders.
Right, near the old Chicago Stadium.
Cambyses, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, Greek-American community. I was born and raised on the South Side. I took on three major turnaround projects in Chicago. You remember the Revenue Department, the scandal-ridden Revenue Department in 1990, and then, of course, Budget Director during the crisis in the early 90s, and then, of course, the school superintendentship. You know, so I've always been a part of the city, and I've always had a love for the city. This is a great American city, and it depresses me to the degree to which this city has been struggling, and the degree to which working families have been just overwhelmed by taxes and fees and red light cameras, etc. You know, I really think the city's heading in the wrong direction, and I think it doesn't have to be that way. I think it's heading in the wrong direction because you have individuals who have been in positions of responsibility who have not been effective managers, number one, and certainly have placed political priorities ahead of the real needs of the community.
Would that include Mayor Rahm Emanuel?
Of course it would. The mayor has had 7 years now. You know, the mayor likes to blame Daley. That's like Trump blaming Hillary Clinton.
Does he really, though? I mean, here's one interesting thing about what's happened just in the last few days. Anyone else criticizes him? Even when I say he said on the Laquan McDonald video, he won't say my name. He'll say some columnists say, right? Well, yeah, what columnist? Okay, dude, that's okay. I understand that. He never criticizes Daley by name, but now he's saying you're the guy who kicked the can down the road.
Well, it
seems to be a little bit difficult, like Gumby. Like a sort of Gumby toy bending over backwards, you know, it's a gymnastic that I don't really see.
Well, first of all, I'm flattered that he's responding so quickly, and I like it. Clearly, I'm probably getting under his skin, and who knows what I'm doing when it comes to his internal polling. But you know, I think I present him with a tough opponent, someone who has actually gone into major crisis situations and has always successfully dealt with those crises. You know, when I revamped the school district in 1995-2001, I inherited a school district that had a projected $1.2 billion 5-year structural deficit, And when I left the school district, I left the school district with, by your own papers admission in an article they did, I saw 2001 cash reserves, total cash reserves of over $1 billion, and 12 bond rating upgrades, and a fully funded pension system.
What does that mean when you rattle this stuff off, 12 bond rating upgrades while you were CEO of the public schools? What does that mean?
Well, what it means, the rating agencies give you upgrades when you are effectively financially managing those institutions and when you are not, to use his terms, kicking the can down the road. The rating agencies look at long-term revenue projections, long-term expenditure obligations, and long-term debt. And if they deem what you're doing as placing the institutions at risk, they give you a downgrade. When they feel that the institution is healthy and getting healthier, they give you an upgrade. So we received 12 bond rating upgrades from the three rating agencies. And you have to remember, I mean, what has he received? A dozen bond rating downgrades? You combine the schools, it's probably a record number of downgrades. In fact, do the schools even have a minimum investment grade? We inherited a district with a minimal, without an investment grade. We had to beg the rating agencies to give us a minimum investment grade so
just
that we could
put you on paper.
And so we could bond to begin to renovate the deplorable schools. And 6 years later, we're a model for the nation. We're the subject of work, we're referenced in State of the Union addresses, et cetera. People are coming from all over the country to look at us as a model. And you know, let me also point out, during that period, we designed our education programs so that we could grow the district. You know, there had been a steady decline of enrollment from like a peak of 514,000 to 404,000 when I took over the district. When I left the district, we had 434,000 students. Incidentally, it's been declining ever since. So we literally were able to generate, we were literally able to attract another 30,000 students to the system.
Why does that mean anything to people who are listening here?
It means a lot because when the system is losing money, it's losing state aid. The money that comes to the school district is based on average daily attendance. So when you have a district that's spiraling downward and that's losing enrollment, what you find yourself doing is you're raising taxes to fund that district, but then you're losing state aid. You're losing state assistance. You're losing federal Title I aid because your population is declining. So it becomes kind of one of those financial death spirals. You see what I mean? We reversed that. In fact, during that period, you know, the Republicans in the Senate, James Pate Phillip, were very reluctant to give Chicago new money, very reluctant to support Jim Edgar's desire to raise income taxes to fund schools. It didn't matter to us because our enrollment was growing and our attendance was improving every year. So we were getting new money through the formula. We were flush with income, you see? And let me also point out, too, and you'll remember this, I created a capital program that spent over $3 billion on school construction, and the debt on that capital program never exceeded 6% of the income. And I took all those construction projects out of the political public building commission. So I was able to literally build 78 school buildings and renovate over 350 buildings in 6 years. And I was paying the same per square footage in year six as I was in year one. And the same old contractors weren't getting the work. And we were building buildings at a portion of the cost that they are building new school buildings today. And I did something else, too. In order to ensure that there was fair share in the community, and this is documented, I'll send you a copy of the report.
I remember it.
We actually earmarked 50% of all the construction contracts to women and minority-owned businesses, and we required that 50% of all the workers be minority workers, and we exceeded those numbers, and we required that 50% of all the workers be city residents. So we helped small businesses. We helped diversify the pool of contractors. We helped minorities. We helped Chicagoans. And that's a fact. And, of course, what happened? What happened, John, a year after I left? They pulled all those projects back into the Public Building Commission. In fact, I think the most expensive high school we built and
Chico High.
Was, right. And you remember when they wanted to build Northside College Prep, I said, we got to put a magnet high school in every region. So I built Walter Payton, before they tore down Cabrini Green and rebuilt Jones and rebuilt Lindblom and rebuilt King. And then I bought the old Mendel campus and built St. Martin de Porres. And then I took the old abandoned Brownsville Army, and I created the Brownsville Military Academy, one of five military academies. So those are facts. Those are facts, because there was a desire here to serve all neighborhoods, to serve all neighborhoods, to make sure that the financial resources. See, I viewed the schools as an economic engine, and I wanted to make sure that the resources got into the neighborhoods, not only in building and improving schools, but helping neighborhood businesses, helping individuals who live and work in this city. And the proof is in the pudding in terms of our results.
One of the stories I remember early on when you took over from to run the budget department, budget director, and I think I might have told you this. I was telling an editor this just a few minutes ago before you came on. You know, I see in the Sun-Times you're chronicled as Dr. Yes, like you said yes to everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder about that. But the story, Jeff Carlin, about Paul is that I was a City Hall reporter then, and I didn't understand. I didn't care about the budget. I was an idiot because the budget is the politics.
That's right.
Right? I was interested at that time in rhetoric and so forth and style. And it was idiotic of me. I was a kid. I was young. You know, I was one of those 27 know-nothings that the Obama administration likes to manipulate when they put the Iran nuclear deal together. But an alderman who was close to the mayor's floor leader, Pat Hewells, decent guy. We kind of fell out over some stuff later. But Pat comes to me and he says, "What's with the Greek? Your Greek friend." I go, "I don't have any Greek friends." And he's like, "What's with Vallis?" I go, "Oh, yeah, because we really didn't know. I didn't really know you."
Right,
then.
Right.
I mean, I knew you from when we were kids, but not when we were, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, we weren't. We didn't hang together.
Right. You were the good student. I was the bad boy. But anyway, Pat goes, "What's with this Greek? Your Greek friend." I go, "What? What are you doing, Pat? What?" He goes, "He's pissing everybody off in the meetings with the mayor." I'm like, "Why? What did he do?" He said, "Every time guys are saying salt, 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 buy the salt, Melrose Park, salt, Melrose Park, salt. Your friend Paul Vallis keeps saying, why do we got to buy the salt from Melrose Park?
Why do we have to dump the garbage in Freddie Barbaro's site?" Remember that? All that
Freddie
stuff?
Freddie Barbaro's land site.
Yeah, yeah.
And the mayor was kind of going along with you, but he really hated it because he had to go along with you publicly in his meetings with his people. And then after he'd go to Pat Hewells, what the bleep is going on with him? And then later, I guess as a payment for these sins, you were sent to the schools, not really to succeed.
It's called internal exile.
But to fail. They thought you were going to fail.
Well, you know, I believe that the mayor, there's different views on whether the mayor wanted the school or whether the Republicans got tired of dealing with the schools.
Right.
The victors write the history, so to speak.
Right,
so
right.
I believe, though, that he sent me over because I could do two things. One is I could figure out the finances, and I had a great relationship with the unions. And you know, you're going to hear in this campaign, because Rahm's going to speak through his surrogates. You know, I negotiated.
What's he going to say? Because let's go over what he said.
Oh, he's anti-labor. He's a privatizer. And he's not going to say that directly because, you know, I mean, he early on when he came in here was going to be Mr. Union Buster, if you remember, until Lewis kicked him in the butt, so to speak.
Right.
You remember his quote in the Sun-Times? I remember, because I was in Bridgeport running the schools, doing the school turnaround there. Bridgeport, Connecticut. The state had invited me in, and I saw the front page headlines. And I knew there, I said it. I said it because I called my brother and everybody, and I said, "Teachers going to strike." The headline was, "Teachers got raises, kids got the shaft." Now, he's right out of the box. And, you know, he got that from, you know, he had those school reformers advising him, you know, and he had Gary Solomon there, you know, and it was like, and the polls were saying, the unions aren't really popular. Great, I'm going to be like the big school reformer, and the first thing out of the box is I'm going to slap the union. And you have to understand, you never, never, never insult teachers publicly. You never say anything, even privately. You don't criticize the troops, so to speak. You know, and I knew then that he was going to that they were going to strike no matter what, no
and
matter
it
what
became
deal.
The FU Karen,
yeah, because I had
thing.
More teachers. I had more teachers call me or see right. me, and they were so individuals who would never even contemplate a strike. You know what I mean? So Mr. Right. Tough Guy got his butt kicked. So the bottom line here
and now,
is
now he's, but he's I don't know if he's successful or not, but he is using surrogates to come out and say. To attack you, saying you're the anti-union,
right,
Paul Vallis? You hate the teachers' union. You supported charter schools. You're
right.
You're the guy. Rahm is now, you know. I guess he doesn't know Ken Griffin anymore.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't know Bruce Rauner.
He doesn't
anymore.
Know Bruce Rauner, even though Bruce made him a multimillionaire.
Right. He doesn't know Bill Daley anymore. He doesn't know any. I guess he knows Mike Madigan pretty good.
He doesn't know Rich Daley anymore. Although he is careful about evoking his name. Right. Although everything is implied.
So all that, you're being cast as the anti-union guy.
Yeah, I know.
Reporters asking you questions. I saw these interviews you've done recently, and that's a fair. These are fair questions.
Yeah.
I'm not criticizing my.
Well,
colleagues.
Let me respond. Let me yeah. respond by saying that if I'm the anti-union guy, ask the police, ask the union president of the police department. Ask Danny Fabrizio, who was president of the firefighters when I negotiated that contract in 90 days, that contract that had been sitting there for 3 years. Ask, well, the late, you can't ask the late Tom Reese, who headed the teachers union, but you can ask his lieutenants. When we would meet monthly to resolve issues. Cosette Buckley, my chief administrative officer, would talk to them weekly. We had what we referred to as continuous strategic bargaining, because I didn't make a move without consulting the union and without getting the union's impact feedback. That's why we negotiated two consecutive contracts on time, and that's why we never reneged on a single provision of those contracts.
But he's going to be. But he's saying, and he did, and this is the thing that amazed me, Jeff Carlin. Hey, Jeff, he amazed me when he said he actually engaged with you and said, Paul Vallis is Mr. Can kick the can down the road. I was amazed that he would actually mention your
right.
name early on. What does that mean for him to do it? And what are you, Mr. Can kicking can down the road?
Well, let me respond by saying that means obviously he fears me as a candidate because, you know, I represent somebody who's coming in. I'm not suggesting that there have not been other quality candidates. I'm not going to anyway criticize the other quality candidates, some who heroically challenged them. What that means clearly is he's facing someone who has a track record, which he's going to try to rewrite historically. I'm going to have to, you know, this is a tough arena here. You know, you got to, if you're going to get in the ring, you've got to be prepared to take some punches and
right.
and to do some effective counter punching. So I'm a, I'm a big guy when it comes to that kind of stuff, and it also means that he's got to start, he's got to start labeling me. So and this is what they're going to do. And I believe that Rahm believes that if he, let's face it, he has a lot of money. He's got a huge public relations team that every day is sending out. Little press releases and things like that,
or
talking about
or telling reporters,
yeah, or
stuff.
Whispering reporters, or sometimes he operates through surrogates he's given considerable financial contributions to. And so, what they're going to do is they're going to try to rewrite my record. What I've got to do is just anytime he hits, I'm going to hit back, and I'm going to hit back harder because I do have a record that I can certainly stand on. But let me say something.
Yeah,
let me say something about the kicking the can down the road. Because he's going to say it, and you're going to hear it over and over again. And it's really important that when you encounter, it's really important today that when people encounter a candidate that's lying or saying something that's blatantly false, that they remember it and that they lock that in their memory. Because someone who lies once is going to lie again and again and again. And we've heard, Laquan McDonald wasn't his responsibility. No, throw McCarthy to the wolves. I didn't know anything about Gary Solomon and a $20 million no-bid contract when we all know that City Hall was pressuring Bizarre to award that contract, and eventually Bennett brought in Bennett, and Bennett awarded that contract. So he's going to use one excuse after another. You know, the guy who is in charge and in this detailed manager, it seems whenever there's a controversy, a blatant controversy, controversy. He's not there.
You're basically saying the mayor lies about Laquan McDonald. You're not basically. You're saying it. You're saying the mayor lies about Laquan McDonald and the $20 million contract that Gary Solomon got, the fellow that went to prison,
right,
in the Barber of what's
do you name? Realize? Do you realize that during that period, they actually awarded three contracts. They awarded a contract. They awarded a contract to a company to provide alternative school services for like $10 million. You have this alternative schools network out there that is struggling and has been doing a great job, and they just give $10 million to a contractor. You all wrote about that. They also gave a contract, a massive contract, to a company to manage the closing of the 50 schools, and they paid them tens of millions of dollars. So here you have the schools that are broke, the schools, they're closing schools, and they're awarding like $40, $50 million in contracts, no big contracts. So what does that tell you about leadership? What does that tell you about priorities? But let me just say one thing, and hopefully this will not be the last time I say it, because I'll probably, if my candidacy generates momentum, I'll probably have to respond to commercials. The bottom line is, in 1995, the legislature consolidated all the property tax levies, so they got rid of the pension levy when they gave the mayor the power of the schools. And incidentally, the union supported that consolidation because the pension funds were flush and they wanted more money for the classrooms. You know, so the mayor then asked me to take over the schools. So when I took over the schools, Jim Francik was our labor lawyer. We went to Jim Francik's office, and within 3 weeks, we had hammered out a three-year collective bargaining agreement with the teachers union. And as part of that agreement, I entered into a memorandum of understanding, an agreement. I did a side agreement with the union that Karen Lewis has waived from time to time when she talks about how the city broke their promises, an agreement that said, despite the elimination of the pension levy, if pensions fell below full funding, we would make the contribution to keep them at full funding. And when we left in 2001, the system was over 100% funded. In 2004, when it fell below 100%, my successors didn't fund the pensions. They didn't put the contribution. In 2008, they didn't. In 2010, they went to the legislature and they got an extension of the holiday. And in 2013, Mr. I Don't Kick the Can Down the Road tried to get Quinn to support an extension of the pension holiday. Incidentally, that individual is Mayor Emanuel.
So in other words, that is kicking the can down the road.
That's right. And let me tell you, he kicked the can down the road his first term. You know, he didn't aggressively tackle the financial issues that the district was, that the city was facing. His excuse was, well, I've got to bring efficiencies to government first, because then I can go to the taxpayers and to ask for more money. What that really meant was, I don't want to make any tough decisions until I get reelected. If the public had known what he was going to do his second term, with the taxes and the over $1 billion in property tax increases and the fees and the fines, or the red light cameras, which incidentally, people, the red light cameras was a revenue generating initiative, not a public safety initiative. It was designed to generate revenue, and it is indiscriminate in terms of one's ability to pay. I mean, just imagine being on a fixed income and getting stuck with that red light camera and then going in and appealing it and losing a workday. I mean, there's nothing crueler or more oppressive than imposing heavy fees and fines on those who are least able to pay. So the point here is if people had known what he was going to do in the second term, Chuy Garcia would have won in a landslide. So you deceive the public for 4 years. You don't take any actions. You totally screw up the schools. Four superintendents in 6 years. You know, Arnie, myself and Arnie Duncan, I think we were there for 14 years. So the point is, you punt. You punt until the second term, and then you just stick it. And you stick it to working families. Because these taxes and fees are not really tied to income. You know, they impact people regardless of their ability to pay it, and they're having their most severe impact on working families. They're making it harder to stay in the city, and you see it in this exodus. And the exodus is across all demographic groups, so it's having an impact. I shudder to think what the next post-election series of tax and fee increases are going to be. We were at the City Club. You had those three learned experts on city finances.
Larry Massal and Fran Spielman.
Right, and no one understands the history of the city or its financial transgressions than all three, and particularly Fran, who has, my God, I mean, she first store in Chicago back when I was in the Revenue Department, Fran did with me, and got me in a lot of trouble when she did it, too, I might add. So anyway, I remember because I angered one of the aldermen, and the alderman called me, and I said, and I innocently said, well, you know, I explained this to Fran Spielman, and then the minute he heard it, he said, oh, okay. So anyway, no, but I, you know, Fran's a great reporter. They're all, you know, they're all great individuals in terms of their knowledge of the city and their commitment to the city. But the point is, what did they say? They said in 2020, we're hitting another we're hitting another cliff. We are nowhere near addressing our long-term the long-term financial crisis that the city is facing. So technically, he's punted again. And if he had acted aggressively the first term, we wouldn't be paying nearly as much the second term. He's been mayor for 7 years. It's, you know, when you blame your predecessors, it's like, you know, Trump blaming Hillary Clinton. You know what I mean? I mean, the bottom line is you've been here for 7 years. What have you accomplished in 7 years? Is the city in better shape? Is the city any safer? Are the schools any more stable? Is the cost of living any more manageable? I think not. So I really think that this election, we need an election that's a contest of ideas. And what I'm going to do is what I've always done, ad nauseum definitely intended to bore people to death. I'm going to talk very specifically about the issues and be very explicit about what I intend to do to make neighborhoods safer, to make the schools better, to address this continual financial crisis that are driving working families out of the city. And I'm going to do it with great specificity and let the election be a referendum on ideas.
I could just imagine Rahm now listening to this and saying, why didn't I come on the Chicago Wave and asked? You know what I mean?
Many times. And
you're still welcome, Mayor Emanuel.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What did you think of that declaration of war from Paul Vallis?
Shots across the bow.
Yeah.
Paul, as citizens of the city, I know this is unrelated to general politics, but the roads, everybody I know, it's the first thing they hate about the city living here is every road is a pothole and a mess, and then you drive through an alderman's neighborhood and it's spotless, and there's snow plowed, and it's clean, and their garbage is always done, and they always get street cleaning ahead of everybody else. How does that work, and what would you do to address my simple concern?
Well, look, no one's ever accused me of having favorites, and you see it in my record in the Chicago Public Schools. Where did I build most of the new schools, and where did I do most of my renovations? In neighborhoods, in working class neighborhoods. When they wanted Northside College Prep, I did Southside College Prep. And, you know, I put a regional magnet high school in every region. I rebuilt the Brownsville Military Academy. I put Lincoln Park International Baccalaureate program in neighborhood schools.
What are you going to do? I know that.
And well, even on the things.
What are you going to do about Jeff's problem if you're mayor now? You're at a news conference. Mayor Vallis, Jeff Carlin can't drive without hitting potholes.
Well,
what are you going to do?
I think what you have to. Well, first of all, you need an infrastructure plan for the city. And one of the things that stood out at the meeting, at the City Club meeting, was there was a consensus that the city has no comprehensive infrastructure strategy. They have no strategy to improve the physical conditions of the city. If you remember, when I took over as budget director in 1993, in those days, if you were a friend of the alderman, you got. Streets renovated and repaired. And if you weren't a friend of the alderman, if you weren't an ally of the mayor, you didn't get support. And if you were an ally of the mayor, you did. And I would sit through those committee meetings where, remember Doherty would say, why are you neglecting my ward? So
Brian, sorry. Yeah.
So what I did was...
Because he was a Republican, that's right. Why.
So what we did was we laid out a strategy where we would allocate resources for every ward, regardless of their political affiliation. And in those days... There was a large anti-mayoral block, you remember, and they would routinely vote against the mayor. So by the time we were done after 3 years, we had renovated something like we had resurfaced 70% of the city streets. And we didn't prioritize based on whose ward. We just did it in every ward. So every year we were going in and we were shoring up the potholes in every ward. We were doing five, six, 7 miles of street repairs in every ward. We were street resurfacing in every ward. We were actually paving alleys in every ward. So the bottom line here was we laid out a capital plan, an infrastructure plan that was affordable.
And you don't think there is one now?
I don't think there is one. Do you see it?
I don't see I do see certain things, Jeff Carlin.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I see? I see remaps drawn.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just saying, hypothetically, since, okay, Brian Hopkins, since you really don't like dibs, dude, you're going to get this.
Uh-oh.
Okay? So, like, the second ward, redrawn. And it gets certain things, like Finkelsteel in the second ward. Okay? Okay, Brian Hopkins works for Johnny Daly. Finkelsteel's in the second ward. It's being, you know, see how that works? And now all that money's going there? Things are coincidences.
Well, let me
Paul
tell you
Bowers.
What I see.
I can't get the coincidence.
John, I see OneTrust Arena, $100 million taxpayer subsidy. Rick Tarlander wrote an excellent piece on that. First of all, you build an arena for DePaul University that students can't get to because it's not anywhere near DePaul University. And then you put it in an area that's not in real need of economic development. Meanwhile, I look at the Rolls and Pullman area. I look at Chicago State University with its decaying infrastructure, and I don't see a TIF. I don't see any state funding coming that way. I don't see $100 million investing in that community. I mean, you know, we've been talking about revitalizing the old Pullman Roseland area since I had hair on my head, and that's been a long, long time. And the community has deteriorated even more. You know, so at
they're
at
still
the end,
holding on. There's a lot
yeah,
of people
I mean,
trying, but
U of I wasn't revived. U of I wasn't revived because the state came to U of I's rescue. Because, you know, we have this tendency, well, it's the state fault, Everybody kicks the can down the road. Or, I'm sorry, kicks the can into somebody else's yard. And U of I, and you remember when we made that tough decision on the old Maxwell Street and we used TIF money and we used state money to basically do the streetscaping and to provide the subsidies. U of I revitalized because there was because the city took an interest in the restoration and the improvement and revitalization at a campus and to use that campus, to use the university as an economic engine in that section of the city. We could have easily done that in other areas of the city.
So why you're saying that the $100 million WinTrust deal is a waste of money?
I think it's getting your priorities in placing that. It's the wrong priorities. It's the absolute wrong priorities. If you're going to spend $100 million in taxpayers' money, invest it in a community that is in need of revitalization.
I'm just a shout out to all the investigative reporters here who listen because, you know, guys, I know everyone wants to be a tough investigative reporter. So if you do, I would start looking at that real estate where they didn't put the arena for DePaul. I would start looking at who is handling the real estate. I would look to see whose ward it is. Oh, hi, Brian Hopkins. I would like to see what kind of infrastructure the county and the city put in over the past 10 years preparing for a huge development. Because you know what, Jeff Carlin? There are no such things as coincidences on the Chicago way.
There's only the Chicago way.
So what else do you want to know from Paul Ballas here?
So, I'll make sure that all the potholes are filled and that there's a steady, you know, the approach that we took was to have a long-term strategic plan. And incidentally, John, in those days, during that period, we actually came out with the state's first comprehensive affordable housing program, too. So, but it was all part of a long-term financial plan that we had developed for the city. So the idea here is to have a long-term infrastructure plan to determine how to fund it and make that funding fit within the budget in a fiscally responsible way, and then to basically have a schedule of renovation and repairs. So you're consistently maintaining the infrastructure. And I'm not suggesting for a second that there's a magic formula to this, or that this isn't going to be hard, or that sacrifices aren't going to be made. And as I mentioned, once I become an announced candidate, I'm not going to be short on details on anything, as controversial as those issues might be. But there is an absence of long-term planning. There is an absence of I have problems with the priorities that are being set. The Wintrust Bank is just the latest example. Well, you know, I have a problem. Let me tell you. I have a problem that he waited till 2016 to impose these developer fees, so to speak, on the downtown development, and suddenly wake up to the reality that he needed to begin allocating money to the West Side and South Side neighborhoods. I mean, 2016, that's
what, yeah, but
6
all the aldermen
office.
Now tell me they're getting stuff.
Yeah. It's the election year. It's the election year.
Is that
year.
How it works?
6 years. You waited the 6 years
and now
to wake
stuff.
Up to the fact that maybe the downtown development should, in part, or at least the income that's generated through these fees, should, in part, fuel some development at the in the local neighborhood.
Let's go on your politics now, because you're talking as a candidate. You're not an announced candidate. What has to happen for you to see if you're going to run or not? What do you have to do?
Well, I think I'm going to get plenty of volunteers. You know, because I've worked in so many public positions over the years, and I've established relationships, there are many individuals who worked with me in the past, many who have retired, who are actually joining the campaign, and they're literally working for me full time. So there's going to be no shortage of people coming in to help me. I have absolutely no doubt about that. And I believe that I'm going to have a lot of support in the communities because, you know, people do know me and they've worked with me over the past. You know, I've run twice. I believe that people who voted for me when I ran against Rob Blagojevich, incidentally, the mayor supported Rob Blagojevich, and he didn't support me. And of course, when I came back,
so did Jimmy DeLeo, by the way.
That's right. A lot of other people. Tom Sacchia. We'll go through the whole list of cast of characters. And of course, you know, individuals who supported me when I came back to try to help Pat Quinn get elected governor. And incidentally, because Ron's trying to call me a Republican, I ran against Rauner. And I think the only thing Rauner has ever bought me is a bowl of oatmeal at one of the local restaurants when he was a private citizen. And we were talking about school reform. He didn't make me a multimillionaire. So, but clearly, I also have to raise a reasonable amount of money, not only to get my message out, but to respond to what will be like a, you know, carpet bombing from Rahm and his surrogates. So,
well, where do you think they're going to attack you on?
You know,
they're going to go after your family. They're going to go after, this is how it's done. I mean, they're going to probably go after your brother. They're going to go after everybody you know that has any kind of deal or did anything, and they're going to make a big deal out of
it. Yeah, you know, it's
you saw how they did with Chewy. They made Chewy to look like the king gangbanger of Chicago, right, Jeff Carlin? Remember that?
Well, you know, I think they're going to do, the classic example is the pension thing. I think they're going to turn around and they're going to say, he caused a crisis when it's the opposite. You know, I was responsible and I was rewarded by the rating agencies. And then they're going to tell that lie over and over and over and over again. Or they're going to say he's the great privatizer when, you know, let me point out that.
Because you supported charter schools.
Because, right. And, you know, very quickly, the charter school law that was passed, this is really important, was proposed by the Democrats. This was the Democratic alternative to vouchers. Pate Phillip wanted to create a voucher system. You remember?
Yeah.
He wanted to voucher the entire Chicago public school system. And the compromise was that Chicago would open charters. When I left the Chicago public schools, we had 553 schools. We had 30,000 additional students in the public system. I think we had hired more than 1,000 additional public school teachers, and we had only 18 charters. Let me say this again, 18 charters. Today we have 120 charters. And I'm not bad-mouthing charters, but you don't close 100 schools on the one hand. And let me tell you, he pressured Brizard, he wanted Jean-Claude Brizard to close 100 schools, not 50 schools,
yes,
but 100 schools.
Well, that was a deal that Rahm made with the people that put him in.
While you're opening new schools.
Those business guys.
Right.
Wanted,
so on the one hand, you're opening new schools, and then you're closing existing traditional public schools. So, you know, I kind of rest my case, the bottom line. But, you know, I'm going to have to be prepared. I'm going to have to be – or you saw SEIU. They criticized me because they said – and they supported Rod Blagojevich too, I might add. But because they said, well, you privatized custodial services. You know, when we took over the Chicago Public Schools in 95, this was during the daily privatization phase where you want to privatize right. everything. And I probably did as much deprivatizing as we did privatizing. But we decided that we were going to hire minority companies from the community – to provide custodial services in our new schools and in our additions. And we're going to have a balance of the existing custodial.
That's not Aramark, though.
No, that's not Aramark. That's not politically. That's, Reverend Jimmy Daniels and neighborhood minority companies.
Who brought Aramark in? Were you the school guy that brought Aramark
in? I don't remember if Aramark was even on our radar screen in those days.
Okay, I got to ask another question. They're going to hit you on Solomon, and I've seen this over and over and over again. The people that went to jail or were charged, he was convicted, I believe.
Yes.
Were Barbara Bird Bennett and Gary Solomon.
Gary Solomon,
And another person, I think.
A guy named Vargas, I think.
Yeah, whatever. And it was all fraud and
right,
in the schools.
Right. Yeah, but basically they're paying, Barbara Bird Bennett or bribing Barbara Bird Bennett to get contracts.
And they're saying, and the argument from the Emanuel camp is that, or through surrogates or whatever, is that you somehow were connected to Solomon.
Yeah, I know. That's another invention.
Because you supported something that he did previously.
Solomon.
Is it true or a lie what he said?
That's a lie, too. Let me point out that Solomon worked for a company called Princeton Review, one of the largest education companies in the country. He was vice president for sales. So Princeton Review did business with hundreds of districts. If you go back and you look at Solomon's old website, you'll see the whole list of who's among superintendents and things like that. And then when Solomon left Princeton Review, he had a search firm. He had one of the prominent search firms that did hundreds of searches,
so
superintendents,
did you do business
principals.
With them in the Chicago Public Schools or any other schools?
No. We didn't do business with them in Chicago Public Schools. Princeton Review was already doing business in Philadelphia. And the state of Louisiana hired him, among a number of other people, hired Princeton Review initially and then later him to do a number of projects for them, including helping provide us with some infrastructure support, because when we went to New Orleans, there was no infrastructure. We had to literally set up almost like a temporary administrative structure so we could hire people, bring people in, and get people paid. And in the 2010, we ceased to have any need for Solomon, and he was gone. This was long before he hooked up with Barbara Bird Bennett, and long before he got into his.
It wasn't Paul Vallis who gave the $20 million.
Yeah, well, let me just point out that Rahm Emanuel.
Wow, I got to say.
Yeah, let me just say this: Rahm Emanuel was responsible for Gary Solomon getting a $20 million no bid contract for the Chicago Public Schools. In fact, I met with Jean-Claude Brizard, just so you know, John, when he was first brought in. He called me and he wanted to meet with me. And we had a discussion of two things. We had a discussion of school closings, because he said he was being pressured to close schools. And I, of course, my position is you don't really save the money you think you save when you shut down schools. And you just can't arbitrarily go out there and close schools, number one. And it's very dangerous to be closing schools while you're opening new schools, because it defeats the purpose. And that means charter schools. Number two, he wanted to talk to me about creating a leadership program. And I actually talked to him about how the launch program, which was Chicago Public Schools' leadership program, which was developed in 1995 in partnership with the union and produced many, many a principal, assistant principal, how they could, in effect, create such a program in-house. And that was the last time he was allowed to have a conversation with me. So the bottom line was, Solomon ran around town telling everybody that he was the chief advisor to the administration, and that he was going to be kind of the gatekeeper on education issues. You know, the worst kept secret in town. So Rahm and City Hall really pressured Broussard, which he resisted, by the way, to give him a big contract, and then Bennett was eventually brought in, and Bennett got Solomon the contract.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history. But, you know, he's going to say these things over and over and over again because it's really, I mean, because his positions are indefensible. So, you know, Putin uses that approach, you know. Things are a mess in Russia, so you try to muddy things elsewhere to say, look, it's just as bad over there, you know. So, you know, it's just, these are things that I'm going to have to, that I'm going to have to respond to time and time again. What's really important is, and Chicagoans are pretty sophisticated about this stuff, particularly people who know me, is what are you going to do to move the system forward? Because the next cliff is coming, and I shudder to think what the mayor will do in his next term, considering the taxes and fees and fines that have been imposed in this firm. So the question is, what am I going to do to make things better? What am I going to do to make the neighborhood safer? What am I going to do to improve the quality of schools in all neighborhoods? What am I going to do to create an economic climate within which all Chicagoans can benefit?
Can you get him into a runoff?
I'm pretty, you know, obviously I wouldn't be running if I didn't think I could at least get him into a runoff.
And one-on-one in a runoff, is Rahm Emanuel the next mayor?
No, I think if I get him in a runoff, I beat him. It's as simple as that. So I'm pretty confident of that. I mean, you know, I've got to prepare to withstand his carpet bombing, so to speak. You know what I mean? Right. I've got to dig my bomb shelters really deep, you know, and I've got to have some resources to do that. But, you know, look, I'm at the stage in my career where I've always been a public servant, and I've thought of doing nothing but public service. And, you know, I was joking the other day. I told my dad the other day, my dad who worked until he was 80, I said, Dad, I didn't get a pension in Haiti. I didn't get a pension in New Orleans. I didn't get a pension in Chile. You know, you don't get pensions for doing that type of work. So I'm probably going to have to work until I'm about 80 like he did. And I hope I'm healthy enough to work until I'm about 80. So for me, it's all about the mission. It's all about the task. You know, people don't realize this. And, you know, particularly when Rahm wants to call me a Republican, before I responded to Ronner's request that I try to help out Chicago State, and we've stabilized the finances in Chicago State. The university has very little debt. The university has a strategic plan to move forward. I worked for a year working for the Justice Department. I was asked by Sally Yates. I was called by Sally Yates. I have to tell you this story. I was called by Sally Yates. Who's not a Republican. And she asked me to assemble a team to look at revamping the prison system. Education and occupational training program.
Federal prisons.
I remember when I got a call. I'm getting a call from the Justice Department. You know, I'm from Chicago. They're calling from me. My first response when she called, I said, "Grand jury." She laughed, right. And she says, "No. We want you to help us." Right. But anyway, you know, my brother says, "Don't tell that story." But it was my reaction. So I said, "I'm from Chicago." So anyway, to make a long story short. We spent about a year, and we visited like 22 different states and looked at programs, extraordinary programs, programs that are having transformational effects, programs that are significantly reducing recidivism. In fact, programs that you can implement so that when people enter the criminal justice system, you're providing viable adult ed and occupational training alternatives to them getting incarcerated, like you have, you know, drug treatment alternatives to incarceration. You now have adult ed and occupational training alternatives. So I got excited about those initiatives. So for the past year, I've been meeting with a number of people. You know, Tom Dart and Judge Evans and incidentally, all for free, Judge Marilyn Johnson and others, talking about how we could create such an infrastructure so we could have a transformational effect. I mean, if you go to the Roseland Pullman community, Ron Carter told me this. You remember Ron Carter from CHN Housing? And he said, he gave me a statistic that I haven't been able to verify, but it was a stunning statistic that the the huge percentage of men who are in some phase of the criminal justice system. And they're out there without jobs and without training. So I saw these initiatives. I saw these minor miracles, these innovative concepts in different states. And I said, why can't we have this here? Well, quite frankly, I'm tired of going around trying to get people to do the right thing. And let me tell you, my interactions with Judge Evans and Tom Dart have been very, very productive, very, very productive. But you know, there are things that need to be done. And I feel, and because there are ideas and programs and initiatives out there that can really be transformational, that can really be game-changing. And I just feel that I need to be in an executive position so that I can implement those things. There was nothing more frustrating for me when I was in Haiti to spend the years that I spent developing proposals to create a functioning, publicly funded school system in that country, and then not having the authority or the power to get the NGOs, the non-government organizations like the World Bank, USAID and stuff, to in effect do the things that were needed to implement those things. So I really feel that there are things that can be done in this city to make the neighborhood safer, to get the schools on track, to really create real economic opportunities for Chicagoans. I'm not talking about, you know, bringing a headquarters in and having people come from the suburbs to occupy those jobs and then getting back on the train and going back to the suburbs. I really think that there are things that can be done, and I'm going to speak to those issues. And then let this election be a moratorium on ideas. Let my campaign rise or fall on my ability to offer substantive solutions to the problems and the challenges of this great city.
It sounds like it'll be an amazing campaign. I can't wait with all these great candidates in it. Rahm Too defending the status quo. Paul Vallis attacking it. Gary McCarthy. Willie Wilson. Who knows who's going to be in, right? Troy LaRiviere. And for all of them, but particularly for Paul Vallis, who's our guest today, and for Jeff Carlin and me, John Cass. You know me as Judge Dibbs. This has been the Chicago Way. Thanks for visiting, everybody.